Coming up on Boston Public Radio, a second juror speaks in the Trayvon Martin case. She says Zimmerman got away with murder but voted to acquit anyway. We'll get your reaction. Then Kelly Crossley talks of bankrupt Detroit, an ugly turn in the immigration debate in D.C., and a royal baby in the U.K. Let's hope she's not as excited as Marjorie. And Boston now allows rental and ownership of mini apartments as small as 350 square feet. In Seattle, micros can be 120 feet. But could you fit in one, much less live in one?
Then Emily Rooney joins us to talk about fear in South Boston following the brutal murder of Amy Lord and the latest on Anthony Weiner, a.k.a. Carlos Danger. Plus, we have a Secretary's Day news quiz. Secretary of Public Safety Andrea Cabral and Secretary of Education Matt Malone both join us for our news quiz. All that coming up, Boston Public Radio 89.7. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So a second juror in the killing of Trayvon Martin, the only non-white juror, by the way, has spoken. Juror B29, now identified only by her first name, which is Maddie, said this to ABC's Robin Roberts.
He's guilty because the evidence shows he's guilty.
He's guilty of?
Killing Trayvon Martin. But as the law was read to me, if you have no proof that he killed them intentionally, you can't say he's guilty.
We want to know what your reaction was to the words of juror B29. Here was what Trayvon Martin's mother said. She says in a statement, "It's devastating for my family to hear the comments from juror B29, comments which we already knew in our hearts to be true, that George Zimmerman literally got away with murder." She also had a lot of incredibly moving things to say. Here's the juror again, Maddie, as she was referenced, talking about how she feels now that the trial has ended.
It's hard for me to sleep. It's hard for me to eat because I feel that I was forcibly included in Trayvon Martin's death. And as I carry him on my back, I'm hurting as much as Trayvon Martin's mom is, because there's no way that any mother should feel that pain.
So again, what's your reaction to the, I think, incredibly moving words from Maddie, B29 juror, 877-301-8970, sounding like she said in another part of the interview, I was the one who was going to make it a hung jury,
yep.
But ultimately I realized on the second day, the longer day of deliberations, that the evidence didn't match what the law was in Florida. And by the way, we're hearing a lot more. This not very different from what Alan Dershowitz told us shortly after the verdict, that the facts just didn't merit the prosecution, not showing obviously a lack of empathy. And obviously, we heard that from the juror there. She referred to the bringing the case to begin with in this interview with Robin Roberts as a quote political stunt on the part of the prosecution, lending more credence to the notion that prosecutors were forced to do something that arguably they didn't want to do because there were 6 weeks of public pressure to bring a case against Zimmerman.
Well, I think there should have been a case brought against George Zimmerman.
So do I. I'm just saying what the juror said.
Oh,
the juror called it a political stunt.
Well, here's what I thought was great about this in some ways. That the first juror, you know, that was interviewed by Anderson Cooper on CNN kept referring to George Zimmerman as George.
18 times in that first day's interview, I counted them.
Okay. 18 times in that first interview when she talked about how George Zimmerman's heart was in the right place. So that was one from the first juror we heard from. The second juror says, he got away with murder, but you can't get away from God. So I was heartened by this, that at least one of those jurors did feel as though he got away with something terrible, and that she felt she wanted to find him guilty of something. What I'm wondering is if there couldn't have been a way. I don't think the prosecution did a great job in this case anyway. They were out-lawyered, as prosecutors often are, tragically, because so many defendants do get away with crimes because they've got bad lawyers on the other side.
Well, but prosecutors are overwhelmed. The caseload of public prosecutors are immense, and defense lawyers usually often can focus on one case.
And as we know, in the state of Massachusetts, pay assistant district attorneys so little that they have to work weekends as waiters and bartenders to make ends meet. But the point is, I know Trayvon's mother said she was devastated, but there's got to be at least a little bit of satisfaction to hear that somebody felt as awful about her son being killed and as awful about this case, even if she didn't ultimately hang tough and resulting in a hung jury in the George Zimmerman case.
Well, you know what's interesting, by the way, is you served on a jury, right?
Yes.
And I've served on a jury, too.
And I love juries.
A jury that was in which there was a divide. If anybody served on a jury out there in which there has been a divide, you should give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. I should just say from my personal experience, no matter how much you believe in your position on an issue, it is really hard when you're locked in a room with people. And I wasn't sequestered. These people were sequestered, mm-hmm. where the pressure is even more intense. It's hard to stand up to withering criticism by all your colleagues. She was a standalone.
Right.
She was the one who wanted second-degree murder. She voted for it on the first day. She was the one, as she said, was going to keep the thing. But it is really hard.
And obviously, the other thing that's very significant here is this woman is Puerto Rican, of Puerto Rican descent. So she's not a black woman, but she's a Puerto Rican woman. She's a dark-skinned woman. She could be subject to the same sort of profiling that maybe that Trayvon Martin was, or her. She's got eight children. I assume one of those eight children is a boy. And may understand mm-hmm. More than someone white what he was going through. And also the fact, like I said, that she's got eight kids. That's a lot of kids. But anyway, she's got eight kids.
She's only 36, too.
She's 36, so she's a nursing assistant. So I found it heartening. You were the lone juror, I believe, that was trying to convince the rest of your fellow jurors, Jim, weren't you?
It was a civil case. And I have to say,
I suppose if you, Jim Browdy, could not convince your fellow jurors, what chance?
No, can I tell you something?
Anybody else have?
You know, on a serious note about that, I know this will shock you. I was pretty convinced, even though I was the lone holdout in this thing, it was about the amount of money that should be given to somebody in a civil, a so-called slip and fall, you know, an injury thing. But even though I was convinced I was right, and I was the only lawyer on the jury, it's pretty rare a lawyer gets picked. It was hard. It's hard. I don't know. I can't remember if it was a 6-person jury or not. It's really hard to stand up to 5 people who are, even if they're being respectful, are on the other side of an issue hour after hour after hour.
Well, one of our favorite emailers, and by the way, our email address is bpr@wgbh.org, Stephen, who's also an attorney, he says, just email, I think she is trying to protect herself from criticism. Her statements seem very self-serving to me. If she really felt those things at the time, she couldn't have held out for even a day or two. Now, your point is that it's very hard to hold out for
a day. Well, she did hold out for a second day. And, you know, again, I don't know if the sentiments are – one likes to think that while you may cook it on a jury if the stakes aren't very high, but when you're talking about a life that was lost and another life that could be lost depending on what your verdict is, you like to think that people are at least do what they believe in their hearts, but who knows. 877-301-8970. You've heard from juror B29. Her first name is Maddie. She was on ABC News with Robin Roberts. What's your reaction to what she had to say?
Let's go to Bruce in Brookline. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Very well, thanks.
I appreciate the call, appreciate the discussion. I, too, have been in a civil case where you had to sort of convince one or the other, and I completely understand how difficult and hard that is, and it's where the most of the population probably won't understand that. I just found her, I have to say, I agree with the lawyer's email. I found it a little disheartening, and I don't know what good came out of it. I can't imagine what the family must have felt when they heard that.
You think jurors shouldn't speak at all? Even by the way, this is voluntary. They were not forced to. The judge obviously didn't say they had to. And I think there's actually a gag order about the names of the jurors that I think continues. Right. But you think essentially they should all just shut up?
Well, I just don't think that. I think that there should be a time limit between this. I just don't think that. I'm not sure what good comes of. When I'm thinking about the family in particular, because mm-hmm. I do believe injustice was made, and so I have that bias.
When you say a time limit, Bruce, you mean like a cooling off period? Is that what you mean?
Correct.
If you're going to speak, I hear you, Bruce. Thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, we get another email from Christopher saying the same thing.
These
jurors have no business speaking out publicly on the case. The comments and deliberations are not in any way helpful, and the discussions need to be taking place in order to move forward.
Do you agree with that? My sense is...
I'd love to hear from jurors.
Yeah, but not just in this... what's the word I'm looking for? You know, you want to be staring in. What's that word that goes with that thing? It isn't just because you want to have the thrill of hearing what happened. I want to know how they came to a conclusion in a case that obviously had pretty dramatic impacts across the country. So I think it's... And by the way, you can make your own judgment. Are Stephen and the first caller right that she was cooking what she was saying, or but and we can make that decision.
Well,
we watch.
Listen, if I were on that jury and I had heard that first juror for hours and hours on CNN saying how George this and George that and George was a great guy, I think I would feel myself. I would want to separate myself and say, hey, not everybody thought that, and I'm the one who didn't think that.
You know what else this non-white juror said in this case? She too said that race was never part of the deliberation. So for those who are suggesting it was just those five white women who couldn't deal with the fact that there was racial profiling here, the other only non-white juror apparently agreed.
Let's go to Paul in Milton. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Paul.
Hi, Marjorie. Jim, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Scratchy line. I hope you can hear me.
No, it's good.
I think I agree that the women should have spoken out, and I'm glad she did. But I think maybe the conviction by the world against George Zimmerman is far better than anything he would have received by any Florida court. It's a life sentence. He's almost now a man without a country. I'm just being shunned, I think, by a vast majority of the world. I mean, his name has become infamous with this killing. And I always go back to what I call the Tom Brady factor. You know, had Trayvon Martin looked like Tom Brady, he'd be alive today.
Well, I happen to believe that, and instantly the President of the United States said something very similar to that, by the way.
He would have a trail of teenagers from the complex following him down the street.
You know, Paul, the only other problem, I am one who agrees with Juror B-29, at least in part, that he got away with something. But, you know, when you hear it, vigilantism is also a scary thing, and it's one thing to be shunned, but I don't know if you've read the piece about there's a woman in Florida whose phone number was mistakenly put on a website as George Zimmerman's, and she has talked about the scores of death threats she has gotten. So again, shunning somebody is one thing.
I know you're not.
Yeah, I'm just saying, but
just
that's the consequence. Yeah, that's the consequence of getting off when at least 50% of the population probably thinks you shouldn't have. Paul, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Good program.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking about so-called juror B-29, going by her first name only, Maddie, who gave an interview to ABC News talking about the George Zimmerman verdict, her saying that she thought George Zimmerman got away with murder. And this was obviously just opposite of what the first juror that had been interviewed said, who believed that George Zimmerman's heart was in the right place. Let's go to Sheila from Norton. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Sheila.
On a lighthearted note, I actually love shunning. I think that's it's a wonderful tool. I'm in disagreement with Stephen, who I love his comments. As an attorney, I was sort of impressed that even though she may have emotionally thought something, she went by the law, and I think that's a perfect example of what a juror needs to do. And I actually was kind of impressed, and I thought it was something that needed to be said for many people who do not sit in the courtroom to hear all the evidence. It troubles me. A lot of times people think they know what the evidence is because they see maybe a clip at night or they read something in the paper. But unless you're in the courtroom and see the dynamics and the nuances of the courtroom, I don't think you can ever understand what a juror goes through. So I actually thought, I think she might have engaged in hyperbole about feeling like the mother, as much like the mother as, as she...
Yeah, she shouldn't have said that.
You mean to cover herself, basically?
No, to say that she feels the same pain as Trayvon Martin's mother. How could she possibly?
Well, she
has
the same pain.
She
can relate as a mother. But maybe she just said that because she knows that she didn't give Trayvon Martin's mother the justice that Trayvon Martin's mother wanted. But Sheila, I know you're a lawyer, and I used to be one, and Marjorie, you're not one. But in any case,
I am not.
You've covered a lot of trials. Most lay people believe, well, I actually am a half lay person, the former lawyer, that jurors often don't follow the instructions or the law. Jurors often make decisions from their gut. Don't you think that's the case? And instantly, I think a lot of people in this country who think Zimmerman was guilty, despite what the law may have been, that's how they wanted the case decided. Don't you think?
Well, I do think, there's like a jury nullification
sort
of sense of things. But I think what we all should remember is he wasn't found innocent. It was just not guilty, and people somehow don't remember that and don't distinguish the two. He may be guilty, but he was not found to be guilty under the within reasonable doubt. but he's not found innocent by a not guilty.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I'm always impressed by the jurors when they do speak out. I think on Hinckley's jury, they all said they didn't want to do what they did with John Hinckley. And I always thought that was a good juror pool. So,
Sheila, thank you for sharing your perspective. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. We are going to Stoughton, where Tom is on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. How are you?
We're very well. Thank you for calling.
Hey, you know, one thing that has bothered me in this case where President Obama brought made the analogy or comparison, if Trayvon were white, would the results have been the same? And also, he said, if the tables were turned, meaning a black man shooting a white youth. That did, in fact, happen in 2009 in New York State, where a man by the name of Roderick Scott shot an unarmed white teenager who was breaking into his neighbor's vehicle. And he was found not guilty of manslaughter. So I just think that the media in this whole case has just fanned a lot of flames. I understand why black people are angry in this country at the verdict. All right. But I would like
By the way, Tom, for whatever it's worth, I'm not a black person, and I share the perspective that it would have been I don't know, and you picked one example, but we could all pick, you know, individual examples. I am one who believes, based upon what I know about George Zimmerman, not having sat in the courtroom, that if maybe even if he wasn't Tom Brady, as Paul from Milton suggested, but he was a white kid in that hoodie, I think the odds are that he would be alive. But I hear you. But continue. I'm sorry.
Okay. And just one other point, too, that nobody was there that night. And as the attorney just stated that, you know, you have to put a little bit of faith in the jury system.
Yeah.
That maybe there's some things that they observe that we don't. And unfortunately, we've gone to, in this country, trial by media. And I'm just very disappointed.
That point is a fine point, I think, Tom. We do convict in many cases.
This was a case where we had a televised trial that you could see vast amounts of the Trayvon Martin trial on TV. You could see entire testimony from witnesses. You weren't sitting there in the courtroom, but you could see the examination, the cross-examination.
Yeah, but do you think the average person sitting at home, even if they were riveted, was listening as carefully to the judge's instructions about what the law was and how what they had to do as they were watching the witnesses in the case?
No. And I think that's one of the – this was a jury that was going to follow the letter of the law. I mean, that's absolutely clear. They weren't going to go off the reservation. They weren't going to say, I've got to find this Zimmerman guilty of something, and I'm going to find a way
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish the thought.
I was just going to say, you know, they could come back and say, we're going to find him guilty of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon.
Yeah, but before you go too much praise of this jury and – our good friend who called a couple of seconds ago, Sheila, talking about how seriously the jury took it. The fact that now two of the six jurors who had different positions initially have said that the jury as a whole never considered race as a factor, to me, says there's a real problem there. By the way, I think you can consider race as a factor and still acquit them. I'm not saying it leads automatically to a guilty verdict, but the fact that you could sit through this trial and believe that race was not even an issue worth discussing suggests to me there was a problem in the jury room. Again, you can acquit and talk about it, but to not talk about it?
Well, I think that's what this trial brouhaha has been about, that black Americans, including the President of the United States, understand how they are racially profiled all the time, as Barack Obama said, going through a department store, et cetera. And we've done a million stories about how every black person's got a story about, you know, somebody thinking that they're a criminal, which is terrible. Lots of white people understand that because they've read it over and over again. So I think that that's sort of extraordinary that it didn't dawn on any of these people, including a woman who's of Puerto Rican descent, that I think the reason George Zimmerman was looking at Trayvon Martin suspiciously is because Trayvon Martin was black.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying so before people shower praise on the jury and their deliberations. I think
I'm not showering. I think they should have done something totally different. I think they should have found a way to find him guilty of something.
Jane, you're in Providence. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thank you much for your call.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, this is the first time in my life I've ever been moved to call into talk radio, and here's the reason I am.
Yep.
I have a question for the two of you. What I'd like to know is how much of the actual trial of the 12 days, about 10 hours a day, and 200 witnesses did the two of you listened to, and how much of the evidence did you actually see as it was being presented in the courtroom?
I listened to all 200 witnesses. Jane, now the truth is, and I know where you're going with this, all I did was watch. I'm going to answer your question.
People.
I saw CNN late at night. I watched Anderson Cooper and other CNN reporters, anchors, cover it nonstop. But I know where you're going, and it's a legitimate point.
Because, you know, the thing is, I think as I look at the demonstrations, And you know, I understand that, you know, I'm not a black person, and I think it was a terrible thing that this young man was killed. However, as I look at the scores, hundreds of people, it's like, okay, so how many of you had made up your mind from the first headline that this guy was guilty? And how many of you took the time or the trouble to really see what was going on? And we weren't in the courtroom, but at least to listen.
But Jane, with due respect, and I like Jim, I watched a lot of it on CNN, and they had a lot of the witnesses on the stand. I was not there in the courtroom either. But I don't think that's the point in this case. I think the point is, in this case, that Black Americans are racially profiled all the time. When you have the Attorney General of the United States talking about how, when he's a federal prosecutor, he's running to catch a movie and he gets pulled over by the cops, I mean, that is a reality that you live with.
Yes.
I think it wouldn't matter what a million witnesses said if no one in that jury, and apparently it wasn't discussed in the case, brought up this whole issue of the racial profiling issue. That to me is the nub of this case.
After discussing it, Jane, even if after discussing it, they said it has nothing to do with our deliberations. It's the failure to bring it up that at least, I guess, troubles both of us.
One man was on trial, okay? And he was on trial with respect to Florida law. And so for people to say who didn't, and Marjorie, I'm glad that you did actually listen and look at it.
Well, Jane.
We had.
Jane. I'm curious to know where you're going. What are you about to say? For those who what?
Yeah, what I'm about to say is that I don't think that you can condemn one man who was acquitted by a jury for hundreds of years of horrible history here.
I think you're right.
Individual's life as well.
I think you're right.
Have people not respect that? I mean, you know, thank God that my child was never killed in that.
But Jane, can I just say, well, I would agree, of course, that he's not responsible for 200 years of whatever. I hope you would agree that to ignore the context in which this behavior happened is almost like denial. Well, but let me tell you, it was a great first call, and we hope you make a second one soon. Thanks so much, Jane.
But here's the other big point of this trial that we haven't talked enough about because we've been so wrapped up with the race stuff is this is a guy who was on a neighborhood watch with a loaded lethal weapon. And he was told...
Legally, though, we should say.
Legally, that's right. But, I mean, that to me is a big problem. I love neighborhood watches. I don't want my neighborhood watchmen to be carrying lethal loaded weapons around the neighborhood. And I particularly don't want my neighborhood watchmen...
But that can't be held against... You're not suggesting it's to be held against Zimmerman.
I hold against Zimmerman his pursuing this kid.
Well, so do I. But I know you'd agree.
Especially after he called the cops and the cops said, fine, we're on our way. And he takes matters into his own hands.
I agree with you completely.
That's a big issue, too. And the idea that we think that that's fine, that people can run around their neighborhoods with loaded weapons, ready to shoot people who aren't walking the right way, I just think that's nuts. I get Florida law. I get the stand by your ground law. I still think... you know, I'm not a fan of Mr. Zimmerman.
Susan in Providence, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Susan.
Hi.
Hi.
I completely understand how that juror feels because I was in the exact same situation last week, though for a much less serious reason. But I was on a Superior Court jury. I was the foreperson for the exact same situation happened. But with me, it was a petty career criminal versus a policeman. And we had to decide if... Basically, what happened was he had been pulled over. The police found out he had an outstanding warrant. They asked him to get out of the car. He didn't. They were reaching in trying to get him to come out, and he started driving away. After about 15 feet, the officers let go, and he left. And of the five charges, the one we had the problem with was assault and battery with a dangerous weapon being the car. So the whole problem was, you know, the prosecution is letting us know that this guy's a bad guy. There was no argument about that. it was an assault and battery with the weapon being the car. And the argument was because, you know, everyone's like, oh, he shouldn't have known this, he shouldn't have known that, which would have been the same thing that with George Zimmerman. But when it came down to it, I had to keep reading over and over again the jury instructions. And the word we kept getting hung up on was intent. Did he intend to assault him with his car? An example the judge gave us was a cigarette. You know, a cigarette is not a weapon unless you intend to burn someone with it. So everyone kept getting off on tangents based on all this other evidence that was given to us to try to make us draw our own conclusions. Here you have a policeman versus a petty criminal, okay? So, I mean, it got very intense. And I just, all I had to go by was to keep reading our very specific rules.
And what was the outcome, Susan? I think I know what the outcome was, but what was it?
Well, because we only had to decide reasonable doubt on that charge, we had to find him not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was nothing in the way that he was driving that made it obvious that he intended to hit the policeman with the car. They were trying to make it just that because the policeman's bodies were in contact with the car while he was driving away. But he didn't peel out, he didn't steer into them. And there were people that were very heated wanting him to be guilty on that, and I just had to keep reading and keep reading. But intent, like with that, George, intent is the word that everybody is having the problem with. So the problem is really with the law. It's not with all this other extraneous stuff.
Well, essentially quoting Alan Dershowitz again from Harvard last week. Susan, thank you for sharing your experience with us.
There are some of us that would follow the letter of the law, and some of us would be vigilante jurors, and I would be the vigilante juror. And I'll tell you a quick story before we move on. Gagan, the priest that had allegedly abused dozens and dozens and dozens of children in the state of Massachusetts, he finally gets to trial because of legalities involving statute of limitations. He finally gets to trial. He's on trial basically for grabbing a kid's thigh or butt, getting out of
a pool.
In a pool. The jury finds him guilty of this very minor offense. Judge gives him 10 years. And I was so happy.
Was that Judge Constance? Somebody? What was the name of the judge?
Forgive me. I don't know. I'll look it up during the break and find out. She gave him 10 years. That was ridiculous. This is a tiny charge, but she gave him 10 years because she knew what he'd done. That's totally
ignoring the law. That's why O.J. Simpson's in jail for decades,
the
right?
The law. But you know something? Sometimes it's the right thing to do. Anyway, enough of that. Actually, it's not enough of that because we're going to ask Callie Crossley about her take on the B-29 juror when she gets up with us here. We're going to talk to Callie Crossley on that and her preview of her Sunday show Under the Radar. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Andy Warhol once said, "Art is whatever you can get away with." The 31st annual WGBH Fine Art Auction is your chance to get away with some amazing deals on more than 140 juried works of art while supporting public broadcasting with every winning bid. Tune in for the live art auction Tuesday night at 8 on WGBH2 and place your bids now at auction.wgbh.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Blue Man Group at the Charles Playhouse, proud to sponsor the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend. Blue Man Group celebrates the arts with extended summer performances every day of the week through the end of August. Information at blueman.com.
And Masterpiece, while studying for his sergeant's exam, a murder causes Constable Morse to choose between the responsibilities of his job and loyalty to his mentor. It's the season finale of Endeavor, Sunday at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 is Callie Crossley. She's host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. If you forget the last three words, she gets really upset, which you can catch here Sunday nights at 6:30. I'm right. Am I right? Am I telling the truth? Obviously. Her laughter says everything.
Okay, go ahead.
She says.
Before we go anywhere, our crack staff here just produced the name of the judge that I mentioned before. Her name was Judge Sandra Hamlin.
And in the Gagan case,
and she was the judge that gave Gagan a big fat sentence, basically for grabbing a kid in a pool. She was sentencing him for his previous crimes. So we were just talking about this juror B-29 in the Trayvon Martin case, who now comes out and says that George Zimmerman got away with murder What do you make of this, Jura?
Well, one thing I want to clarify, she described herself to Robin Roberts, who did the interview, as a black Hispanic. So yeah. She does consider herself to be black and Hispanic.
She does,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so I want
that's
to put that on the
actually,
record.
Yep.
There are two words that come to mind when I listen to her, intentional and race. I've now come to believe that in that room, I don't know what they think talking about race is, but they were talking about it because, you know, you cannot not talk about it. If you think about, if you are discussing George Zimmerman's calls, all the calls he made prior to this were all about black men going through the neighborhood. Okay, that's discussing race as far as I'm concerned. The call that he made with regard to Trayvon Martin said he looks suspicious and these blankety blanks always get away with it. What is that? But a discussion, you had to, that's part of the evidence. You had to have that discussion.
But the fact that they consider to not have discussed race
is weird.
It's weird. Whether weird or not, it is a huge kind of thing in the
Absolutely.
Room.
Absolutely. It's just interesting to me. So I don't know what people think talking about race looks like. I also think the jury instructions were confusing. Now, you're a lawyer. You probably read those.
I'm sort of a lawyer.
You know,
go ahead.
And you know, I saw other lawyers who are commentators saying they could barely understand it. So that here's the jury trying to figure out. And remember, they called out once to ask, give me some clarification. You know, what exactly are we supposed to be doing here in terms of looking at the evidence that we had and making a decision? I think that was big. And let's go back to intentional. So both now, 29 and 37, have said, because 37 said, he stalked him. Okay, if you know that he stalked him, that to me is intentional. Maybe I don't know how to define it. Wordsmiths, help me. I guess I just don't understand what you're looking for to demonstrate intentionality.
But his lawyer would say, okay, fine, even though he wouldn't, he stalked him, but that's not relevant. Nor is what Marjorie was concerned about.
I think it's relevant.
I'm just saying legally relevant. I'm just saying what the arguments are. Nor is it legally relevant that I hope something that I hope everybody is upset about that he ignored the advice of the 911 people. If it turns out he felt that he was at great risk, those things are not part of the consideration. That's what the defense attorney said, and they carried the day.
Well, there you go.
But
I just don't understand the legal definition of intentionality.
These lawyers are so wrapped up in these technicalities, and the jury instructions in every trial are so damn confusing. It's amazing anybody can understand them. You see juries all the time saying, okay, we think this person did it, we think this person didn't do it, and they find a way to get there. I mean, I think the classic example of that is the O.J. Simpson case.
Yeah.
They saw overwhelming evidence against O.J. Simpson. They said, this is a racist police department. We're not going to believe anything they said. Not guilty. I mean, I think,
I have to say, Marty, you're suggesting, and I made this point to Sheila McCall before, you're suggesting this is the way jurors should behave. They should basically say, okay, we heard the law. Thank you, Judge. But here's how I feel about this case. I'll tell you, if I was a defendant, I would like them to follow the law, not decide in my gut, I think Jim has done something horrible.
Right. But in this case, the point I'm hoping I'm making clearly is that they were confused about what was the law because the jury instructions were all over the place. So be that as it may, it's powerful that she comes out now, and I felt so much for her that she's carrying this around saying, you know, the guy got away with murder and I contributed to it and oh my goodness. And she couldn't have been a more perfect juror in this way. She wasn't there when it happened. She just moved there. So, I mean,
just a few months ago. That's right.
So,
that's a very good point.
She came sort of pure, if you will, to be able to listen and to, you know, ascertain. I hope that someone who has written law cases and emotional cases like this is writing the story and interviewing all of the jurors and all the participants, because I would really like to try to understand
what
happened.
Just one last thing, so I don't look like I'm a lunatic here in the law stuff. I think the point is, for a classic example, is joint venture. When there's four people involved in a murder, one is the shooter. The law is they're all just as guilty.
But no, it is not. The law
if you're
in the car but have no – this relates to the Hernandez case. Mm. If you're in the car, you were there, you had no idea what was happening, nor were you in control of the situation,
if four people go in to rob a store and the store owner gets shot and the four people are in there robbing the store, they're all
– in that situation.
And that's exactly. That's a joint venture kind of thing. Juries don't like to do that. They like to give more time to the juror – I mean to the shooter than the non-shooter. So let's move on
to somebody who is equally unpleasant. Well, I don't know if he's equally unpleasant. I don't know if you've ever heard of Iowa Republican Representative Steve King. Here he is the other day. He's, as I say, a congressperson talking about immigrants, particularly young immigrants from Mexico.
They aren't all valedictorians. They weren't all brought in by their parents. For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that They weigh 130 pounds, and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert.
And he went on to refer to these young people as drug mules, a very attractive term. Now, Speaker John Boehner, unprompted, by the way, my understanding is, well, he wasn't even asked a question about it. In the last 24 hours, here's what Boehner said about his fellow Republican, Congressman King.
Earlier this week, Representative Steve King made comments that were, I think, deeply offensive and wrong. What he said does not reflect the values of the American people or the Republican Party.
Now, Kelly, let me say something I think is totally counterintuitive. Mm. I think what King did is going to help immigration reform. If people like Boehner and others, and Boehner has been, pretty much been on the right side, he's trying to get his the Tea Party Republicans in line on this. If Boehner excoriates a fellow Republican, and most people of goodwill, regardless of where you are on immigration, say this was nauseating, these were horrible comments, I think it creates a little pressure to do the right thing.
That was my initial response, and then I heard somebody give a very persuasive comment about how it may just, what they may hope to do is, as anyone would want to do, is like put this guy in a closet and just slow the process down until everybody sort of gets off the topic, and then they can sort of revisit it, because there is still very strong opposition. And as we know, John Boehner struggling with two divisions in the party, trying to bring them together around this. And what the House is loath to do, even if the bill is one in which some could maybe see some reasonableness in it, is to support the Senate version of this. So that's never going to happen. They want to have their own version. Now you got a crazy guy that everybody is putting distance to. And by the way,
he's on the Judiciary Committee, by the way, which is making key early decisions. I'm sorry, but that's pretty important.
It's very important. And it should be noted that he just didn't make the one comment in the committee meeting. He then went on to the floor of the House and talked for, I don't know, an hour or so crazily, and doubled down on his comments. Like, I don't care what you people are saying, this is what I believe. And, you know, the kids who are dreamers, the ones that were brought here illegally by their parents, some of them went to his office with cantaloupes, by the way, to make their point.
Yeah,
like,
great.
Hello, you know, this is not what's going on. But it's embarrassing. It's, you know, clearly, now, if you want to talk about, there's a guy who has I was listening to Michelle Martin's show the other day, and there's a guy with a website called Yo, Is This Racist? This is racist.
Yo,
for anybody who needs to know, this is clearly racist. It's a gold standard. And I just don't get it. I think, for once, I'm happy to see people stepping out in the party, because usually they don't want to, you know, jump on, up and down on their fellow lawmaker. But this time they said, you know, not acceptable.
Yeah, but that's,
you know what else is really offensive about this? I mean, every year we talk about how the valedictorians, he's saying one in a million or whatever it is, are a valedictorian. Everybody else is a drug mule. I mean, you look at the valedictorians of Boston High School year after year after year. Half of them, if not two-thirds of them, are kids that just came here from other countries. You hear all these stories constantly about, and I know it's the anecdotal evidence, but kids getting out of very good colleges here that came here illegally with their parents and now can't get jobs because of their status.
Well, clearly he knows that. That's why he said.
Tens of thousands and thousands, if not millions of people. So it's just crazy.
But, you know, King may not be as stupid as Steve King as people think he is. There's an expression that I think was coined around the time of Ronald Reagan, government by anecdote, that if you tell a story, one story, it captures the imagination of people to the point where maybe that carries today. I was the head of the union, represented legal services lawyers and secretaries and paralegals around the country. Ronald Reagan talked about a case in Connecticut where public dollars paid for a lawyer for someone who was trying to get a sex change operation. Mm. It happened to be factually accurate. That became legal services to all opponents of the program in Congress. Everybody talked about the one thing. And so maybe Steve King is hoping that this cantaloupe talk, this drug mule talk, is what ends up driving the opposition.
Here's what's so sad, and this should be noted, that after he made his comments, one of the other members, Republican members, came out and was very offended and made his comments, but also said the press had picked up only on that and, in fact, had ignored several other Republicans who had come to testify in support of at least the Dreamer part of the immigration reform bill. And he was offended by that, saying, you know, you always go to the crazy people and the people who have something something thoughtful to say, never get any air. Well, he said that before the guy went to the House floor and doubled down on it. So, you know, he can't win either.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you wanted to talk about Detroit, and it's a terrible situation, what's happened in Detroit, this bankruptcy situation. What's your take on it?
Well, I've been watching it because I just have that sort of eerie, scary feeling that, you know, that's not an isolated case here. Everybody's looking at it because what happens there is really going to, you know, be like a ripple in a pond, and it's going to affect everything else. And lo and behold, I pick up an article in U.S. News World Report, and here's what it says. One 2011 paper from California-based think tank, the Milken Institute, showed Chicago, New York City, San Francisco, and ding, 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 Boston had even more unfunded pension liabilities per household than Detroit. Now, you know, this is kind of scary business. So there's the one thing that it's definitely going to have a ripple effect, and we need to pay attention to it. But I am troubled by it. We made a promise to these people. They took smaller paychecks so they could work. They said, you know, Detroit said, or all the powers that be said, we can't afford you even at a reasonable rate. By the way, the average salary, $19,000. We're talking policemen, teachers. I mean, these are not people to,
they
you know, milking.
Talking
folks.
About as part of the fix post the declaration of bankruptcy, and this is something Marjorie and I have been debating for years. They're talking about cutting the pension benefits of people who had earned them, 83%. And there's an image. There's an even if you think, and I know you do, Marjorie, and I'm not quarreling with you, that public pensions are out of control. When you make a commitment to someone, and someone has done their work life, maybe staying at a place primarily because of what they're going to get in retirement. There's a story, one of the stories I read this morning about a cop. They describe him as this burly Detroit cop who is practically in tears when he finds out that his $40,000 pension will not be transferred to his new job. And, you know, imagine yourself, anybody.
No, it's horrible. I can't. But you know, there is a quite... Well, it's not simple depending on how deep you're in debt, but the problem is the early retirement years. It's not the public pensions. Most of them are very modest. $26,000, I think, is the average in Massachusetts. It's that people are retiring in their 50s and living to their 80s and 90s. That's the problem, and that continues to be the problem. Deval Patrick, to his credit, has changed some of that. He used to be able to retire from the MBTA after 20 years service, like 40, and start collecting for 40 years. And that's what's bankrupting all these cities and towns. People live longer, happily, now. You got to work longer.
Well, I think that, you know, I take your point, and to your point, you've always been arguing for this needs to be changed, and cities, I know that cities across the country have worked to make this kind of change because they recognize that they cannot afford this. But for people who have already done it, you know, I think you got to grandfather and then go forward. I think you got to figure out something else. They're talking about we're doing this, we're cutting by 3 or 30% possibly to, you know, some of the people in the group because we're spreading the pain around. I'm sorry, you didn't spread the pain around when they took a smaller paycheck for all those years. That's just... I know it sounds silly to say it's not fair.
But the other thing is, there's been a lot of talk about you comparing jobs in the private sector and the public sector. It's not always true that the public sector jobs are less money.
No, but I'm talking about now, if you want to talk about Detroit, the average salary is $19,000, according to this U.S. News and World Report.
Yeah.
In 2009, the federal government decided to funnel $80 billion, I think I have the number right, into GM and Chrysler in the very same state that Detroit's gone bankrupt, in part to prop it up. Obviously, they've come out of that, and it was successful. Why is it that Detroit's – no one, the governor is not asking for it. The president says he's not going to do it. The whatever it's called, the emergency manager, who is the, you know, the sort of de facto mayor for the time being. Why is there no discussion? I'm not sure there should – the outcome should be this. But why is there no discussion about what's good for Chrysler and GM is good for the city of Detroit, particularly to protect the pensions and other things of the people who work there?
Well, I think, and I have nobody's told me anything, and this could just be a guess, is that with the GM scenario, they had an ability or the promise there or the hope there was that they would come out of it and return the investment, you know, fairly quickly.
I'm sure it was, yeah.
So now you have a situation where these people cannot return the investment. They've already invested,
right?
You know, so, you know, there's nowhere to go there for them. I think looking forward, you come up with something that, you know, figures out. I don't know. I'm not a city manager. I'm sure people are in the car screaming, you're sure not. But I'm just saying, so I'll freely admit that. But I just get so scared thinking that if you tell people this and I'm not Well, you I'm see not it wealthy, in California. So this hurts me.
You see it in California. I mean, the terrible impact on the schools there, the public schools, the public colleges, because they can't afford their pension obligations. It is going to happen all across the country. And my guess is why they're not running in to bail out Detroit is because it is going to start happening. Right. I mean, Detroit's unique in that it was a one-industry town, and that industry's had its travails, obviously.
And there should have been intervention earlier.
Right, exactly. It's part of America. Yeah. Yeah. You know, this. Yeah. It's in any case. Now, I was nosing around the newsroom in the last 24 hours, Kelly, and I had the horrible misfortune of hearing you actually mention the words Prince George. Was that? Please tell me, before we move on here, please tell me you were not as infatuated with this absurdity. And look at the smile on her face.
Me
in the
too.
UK,
I'm with you, Callie.
As Marjorie
totally.
Is. Go ahead. You plead guilty. You're about to,
I do
right?
plead guilty because this is, I guess it's my little guilty pleasure. I do not know these people, clearly, but but it's something about the fact that they are trying so hard and seem to a little bit, to have some normal experiences. So I just sort of relate to their pushing against the forces. I love the fact that they waited 4 hours before they announced the birth of the baby so they could call their friends.
That's right.
Now, I thought, hey, you know, they told the palace, just wait a minute, cool your jets. We're telling our friends first. I love that. I love, you know, and then I'm interested in all the retail business around it. You know, the swaddling cloth the baby was in and then the christening cloth.
Yeah.
They're sold out. You can't find
it's
one anywhere.
Thing.
So
that's great.
A boost to the economy.
I have to get my commemorative plate.
Yeah,
I
not to mention the dress.
$50 or something.
Can you
know
I read
what else
you
I love about
sorry.
This? I love the fact that, I mean, here we are with the wieners here in the United
God.
States of America. And, you know, there's all this sort of mess. Over there, they've got this young couple, seem to be in love. God. You know, she's so happy. He's so happy. This is a happy, upbeat story. The news is full of death, destruction, murder, and mayhem. And here you have. And I'm also hoping that, unlike in the Princess Diana situation, I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, whenever it was, to watch that wedding 20 years ago. And it turned out that, as Diana said, there were three of us in the wedding bed from the beginning.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
You hope that this is a good marriage and they're going to be happily ever after.
So, okay, fine. Now,
and then, wait a minute. And how can you not like a woman who calls her hairdresser to get that hair together before she goes out?
Exactly.
To
me.
Okay, I'll tell you how. I'm going to read an excerpt from a New Yorker piece entitled okay. Notes from a Royal Baby Skeptic. One of our interns found this. And it quotes from Republic, which is an anti-monarchy group. Listen to this. Occupying the palaces, we have a family of fairly ordinary, uninspiring individuals who represent the very worst of Britain, snobbish, elitist, and utterly out of touch with the rest of the country. The Windsors just keep on taking from the taxpayer and giving very little back. The most talented and accomplished commoner is expected to defer to Princes Harry and William. And it goes on. That's all true. Look at the smiles on both your faces. Like
first
a pox
all,
on the Republic or whatever.
First of all, if you knew about Kate Middleton's history, she was a commoner. Her
That's
parents
right.
were commoners.
And
they
no
know,
more.
With coal miners on her side of the
exactly.
family.
Exactly. They made a lot. So she understands, you know, the common man's plight. I think they didn't make money until she was a teenager
right.
or something like
and
that.
And she's so, at home with those people. And by the way, they make money on tourist gadgets. So
they
they're not,
absolutely
they're not,
do.
So they're not, you
we
know.
Love
well, so wait a second.
The swaddling cloth that sold out. It was
fine.
Only, it was
okay,
$68.
We heard that already. That's good. Now
it was $68.
Fine,
it wasn't
Kelly.
$600.
Now we know
saying.
That surely is not your under the radar
no.
story. What is your under the radar story for well, Sunday night at 6:30?
I like these interesting, you know, stories that pop up in the communities, as you know. And this is one that I, you know, I just don't think about. Big company PEG Properties and Design. They have to pay $25,000 because they just cut down trees willy nilly, public trees, so that they could build, you know, enhance the beauty of their luxury condominiums. As we know, luxury condominiums are popping up everywhere. And I guess these builders just figure, you know, if it's in the way that where we're building, we can just do whatever. It turns out, no, you can't. So $25,000 is not much for those big companies. I understand that. But the bottom line is it's more than just they're getting away with something. It really destroys the whole thing. You can't get the new trees to grow back. You know, it's a whole environmental problem for you just be ripping up trees without asking anybody.
Did you
so
realize?
The
did
community
you realize?
Is kind of annoyed about it.
You were standing within 3 feet of one of the most legendary tree savers in the history
no,
of Cambridge.
No, I did not.
Yes, you are.
Oh,
actually.
Yes.
Did you?
Yes, Jim was going to
latch yourself to a tree.
Well, I latched someone else to a tree.
He
actually.
Was supposed to latch himself to a tree. Were you a city councilor at the time?
I was. It was one okay. of my star turns
That's
on
right.
the Cambridge
star
City Council.
He's going to chain himself to this 150-foot tulip tree.
No, 150-year-old tulip tree.
Okay, whatever.
Yes.
150-something tulip tree. Yeah. And he's going to do this. And when the trucks come out with the chainsaws, mm-hmm. Jim is going to stand between the chainsaws and that tulip tree. But somehow it turned out that the person that was actually changed the tree was this little old lady.
Well, she wasn't old.
Because Jim said when it started to rain that he had to go to Starbucks.
I got coffee for all the protesters. I just have one thing to say, Kelly, despite Marjorie's totally disrespectful take on this major moment in my life.
Yeah.
Ask me if the 150-year-old tulip tree is now 160 years old.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
There you go.
Kelly Crossley.
Because of that
woman
came to Bridget. She was 5'1". She weighed about 75 pounds.
Well, I just want to, this sounds like a little thing, but as these new mayoral candidates are looking around and want to talk about development, you know, let's just get serious with some of these developers and be clear about what they can and cannot do as they're putting up their various buildings.
It matters in cities. It makes
it
more livable in the
Absolutely.
Field. Kelly Crossley will be listening Sunday night at 6:30 Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you very much,
Kelly. And I think there'll be a lot more news this weekend on the baby's progress in its early days of life. We can follow.
So stay off the phone in case Marjorie calls.
Okay.
See you later.
All right. Speaking of development, Boston is backing a big development, but it's all about living small. Teeny, tiny, small. That conversation next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
How well can you multitask?
The tragic irony of the 21st century is the people who most frequently multitask are least able to multitask.
I'm Kara Miller. This week on Innovation Hub, we look at the price we're paying when we respond to every email, tweet, and text. That's Saturday morning at 10 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Northeastern University, where researchers are creating sophisticated computer programs to put the world's cyber criminals out of business. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, proud sponsor of the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, presenting a special summer event now through July 28th, offering floor samples, stock, and more. MitchellGoldBoston.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Are you having a hard time buying or affording rent in Boston? Well, a solution may be near. The Menino administration is thinking small, approving construction of units for rent or ownership as small as 450 square feet, and in one part of Boston only, one limited place, as small as 350 square feet. So the question is, hopefully they'll be more affordable. That's part of the thinking. But are they livable? Would you be liberated by living the less is more life? Does it beat having a roommate? Or would this be your idea of hell? 877-301-8970. You know, I read the story in the Globe. Was it today? I think it was today by Casey Ross. Almost every city is doing this. And by the way, in Boston, to qualify, you got to be, I think, within a mile of public transit, because the whole notion is they want to deal with density, get cars off the street and that sort of thing and make things more affordable. Listen to this. In San Francisco, they have approved units as small as 220 square feet.
I know.
And in Seattle, this is surreal. Developers are building apartments, I'm reading from the Globe, as small as 140 square feet. So we want to know, again, if you're having trouble affording rents, and rents are really high in this town, or buying your first condo or whatever it is, does something, let's say, it'll take 350 square feet, sound appealing and livable to you? 877-301-8970. Could you do it?
How big is the studio?
I am guessing it's maybe 400 square feet, maybe 450 square feet. I'm guessing. I don't know. 450 or something.
So if this is 450, we would be living in a building like a third of the size of the studio?
Not a third, maybe two-thirds. But keep in mind, you also, our studio, as far as I know, does not have a bathroom. Our studio does not have a kitchenette. It doesn't have a refrigerator in it. So there are a lot of things you need to not only to be up to code, but to also live a normal life. So it's a very confined living space. But I guess the trade-off is that...
wouldn't be entertaining.
Well, you might. I mean, if you read about these things, there's a magazine called Think Small or I'm Small or something. I don't know what it is, but something. This is, in many places, the wave of the future. And we want to know if the trade-off is one that you would find to be appealing. Again, arguably more affordability, your ability to live in the city. And again, because they will be near transit connections, the hoped-for outcome is you won't have yet another car in the city. You know, I mentioned this to you before. The best apartment I've ever lived in my whole life was on Barrow Street in the West Village when I was in law school. Now, who years
used
later
to live there?
Well, it was actually a couple of decades later, but that's where Giselle Bundchen had her house. I lived in a single room apartment. It was the best place I ever lived in. And I would guess, I'm thinking back, maybe 400, and I'm a fairly big person, so you know.
You are.
So 425, maybe 450 square feet with a kitchenette, with a bathroom, and in some ways, it's not just that it made it more affordable. I was actually in an illegal rent-controlled apartment, but that's the statute of limitations.
You were just giving me lectures on the laws, weren't you, Jim?
I was, but this is a different kind of situation. It's about my living circumstances. Okay. But you want to know something? There was an appeal to have everything not literally within arm's reach. I'm not sure I would have wanted to live my whole life there, but it's a transitional thing. I like this idea. I mean,
it would force you to be very disciplined. I mean,
it does.
You couldn't have clutter everywhere. You'd have to sort of neaten things up. It would force you to look at what you really wanted in your apartment, what you really didn't want. The downside that people say about this whole thing, of course, it's really for single young professionals, but they're trying to. There's a whole burgeoning growth of single young professionals in Boston, and so they want to give them more opportunity, some place to live. They're still not cheap. These places are talking about renting for $2,200 a month. These little teeny tiny apartments.
Well, yeah, I have to say, I wasn't that clear from this story whether they were talking about those rents for the mini places, or those are the rents the mini places were trying to overcome. But that is a problem in light of the fact that we have no rent controls in this state anymore, because obviously it was repealed by the voters, I think in the 90s. How do we know, considering the housing market is as tight as it is, even if they build, what is the goal, 30,000 more units, I think the Menino administration said, in a handful of years, how do we know because of the limited stock, if the rents aren't going to be ridiculous, even though the apartments are half the size or two-thirds the size or whatever?
I don't think you could be a hoarder and live in one of these places.
No, I think that's probably
right. Do you think so?
877-301-8970. Even if you're not in the market for this, think back to a time when you couldn't afford the rent, or maybe it's now, the rent or the purchase price of a condo. Can you imagine living in a space? I'll do the math for you. 350 square feet is 20 by 17 and a half. And that includes, again,
it's like a cell,
a bathroom facility,
it's like a big cell,
a kitchenette, I assume, or stove and a little refrigerator or something, that kind of thing. It is a relatively tight, confined space. 877-301-8970. The thing I can't, it gives me hives thinking about 140 square feet. In 140 square feet in Seattle is a cell. I mean, that really is practically, it's an 8 by 15 feet, a little bit bigger than a prison cell. I mean, that's really bad.
Yeah, I don't think I could do that.
You know what the only problem with that place is? You have to sleep standing up. That's the only way you can. Let's
take a few
calls.
One of those Murphy beds that they pull down from the wall,
right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, the guy that we talked to about this before said that's what he did.
But you can't pull them down. I mean, you can have them in the wall, but if you pull them down,
maybe you get them halfway.
Exactly.
Climb in.
You sleep at 45 degrees. Okay.
Doug from Rhode Island, what do you think about teeny tiny apartments, Doug?
I live in one, and it's on wheels, and it's actually as small as you just were afraid of.
Well, describe it. What are you talking about?
It's on wheels?
I built a super insulated foam core wall system, and it looks like a tiny little cape, and it's got a loft. It's about 8 feet by 20 feet. I put it on a car trailer, and I can heat it with a birthday cake. Last year, I spent $100 in propane for the year.
I love this guy.
Wow.
I sleep in a loft upstairs. A Murphy bed could actually work if I changed my gable design, but it would have to pull down with the gable direction. I actually built a rolling window seat, which is also a tool compartment, and then the top pulls out to be a bed for a guest.
So, Doug, before you go ahead, you said 8 by 20, right, 160 square feet.
On the bottom, yeah. And actually, honestly, inside, because the walls are pretty thick, it's actually more like 130 or 140 on the floor, and then I consider half of the upstairs loft.
Did you do this by necessity, or did you do it because you thought it would be a cool thing to do?
It was half and half. My college loans are more than I would pay in rent. Mm-hmm. Now my rent is $80, including electricity. I'd been a solar designer before and kind of an eco energy nut back in the 70s in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach in a prison system setting in a therapeutic treatment high school. And because I love my job, but the salary is not what it would be in a public school, I'd rather have a job I love and kill the cost other ways. And this is really allowing me to save a tremendous amount of money.
Well, you are incredible.
If Edgar B. Herwick III, the resident expert on restrooms, was with us, he would say, where do you go to the bathroom, Doug? What's the bathroom deal?
It's the coolest toilet. It took me a year. That was the hardest decision I ever made. The toilet is made by people who make these for the Army and the Park Service. They're made out of recycled plastic. They look like a regular toilet in shape. You poo into a closable thing like an airplane toilet with the little lid,
mm-hmm.
and that goes into peat moss, which has a computer fan, I kid you not, a computer fan which runs the air outside through a downspout, and it dries things out. You twirl it in the peat moss, and it's basically constantly turning back into humus.
Ah!
And then in the front, girls or guys, when you sit down, you pee. Those go into two little holes that go down into a removable jug that you dump about every 2 weeks.
You must throw a mean party, too, Doug, I'll tell you. Hey, Doug, we don't want you to hang up.
Yeah.
Stay on hold. We want to get your phone number. We may
we
get you in here someday.
Absolutely do. This is an incredible story,
Doug.
Stay
on hold. How proud is that guy? Listen to his voice. Well, I mean, how proud is he?
Can you imagine?
No.
God.
I'll tell you.
I can't even, you know.
I know what you can. Okay, let's go to Bruce in Marblehead. You're next. I don't know if you can top Doug. That's a pretty high bar there, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce.
Well, I can and I can.
Go ahead.
I can build it. All right. I'll give you a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I live in elderly housing built in the early 60s. It is one square room, I would say. I've never actually measured it, but it certainly is not 20 by 20. It has a divider, which goes two-thirds of the way down the center. And you have your bedroom space on one side, your living room space on the other side, with a galley kitchen. The bathroom is a cutout. I mean, it cuts down on the space, but the door is in the bedroom. The divider functions as kind of Japanese-style closets and drawers. It's usable. It's limited. Would I live elsewhere if I could? Well, I'm not that elderly. Sure, I've lived in Marblehead for 35 years. You try living in Marblehead. You can't rent a closet in Marblehead for under $1,000. And believe me, the closet is not going to have a water view.
But, Bruce, now, I understand it wouldn't be your first choice, but you sound relatively content in it. Is that a fair statement?
You know why? I'm
what?
74 years old. It gives me security. The rent is, of course, controlled at 30% of my, please hear this, gross income.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Not income after deduction.
I understand.
All right, it goes up every year if Social Security throws me a few more bucks or if Jim and Marjorie take me out to lunch and I don't get a receipt.
Hey, Bruce, thanks for a great call.
That
we really
is.
Appreciate another great story.
Well, it must be cozy, too, you know.
But, I mean, there is a claustrophobic question, too, and obviously everybody is there. But, again, I'm big and I'm also fairly claustrophobic, and I was totally fine in my place in the city, in New York City,
and
years
also,
and years ago.
In a lot of these places that you read about, they have sort of a not a gathering space, but what do you call it? A common area, mm-hmm. where people can kind of go and hang out.
You mean if they're multiple small units, yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so you don't...
You know what the common area is called?
What?
The bathroom. That's just the... Let's go to Tim in Boston. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. We're talking about the city of Boston giving approval to these mini units, 350 to 450 square feet. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent.
Yeah, I actually moved into a 425 square foot unit in Boston in the South End when I first moved here from New York. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I got in at a time when a unit like that sold for about $250,000. And the lessons I learned about living in a small place in New York were great because I learned that if you bring something into the apartment, something has to go out. And so learn to live as a very, you know, efficient person with not a lot of stuff weighing me down was great. The great thing about getting in there, though, was that 2 years later when I put it up for sale, the inventory within the South End for apartments that size was so limited that it drove the price way up in terms of the bidding and the competition for purchasing it from me. And I actually made about $150,000 on it in just 2 years.
Mm. Wait a minute. So what did you sell it for?
I sold it for $379,000.
Wow.
And it really afforded me the profit was able to then be put onto a much larger unit that I moved into in the South End in 2005. But I just have to say that people who make the step to move into a small place, is obviously you sacrifice a lot, but what you get in return in terms of city living, the ability to walk out your front door and be exposed to all the urban benefits that are available in a neighborhood like the South End. I mean, I just thought that was a really worthwhile trade-off, and I don't regret it a bit.
Three eloquent testimonials. Tim, thanks for the call. You know what I'm thinking as I'm thinking about the small space? The three people who have spoken to us so far, each one of whom lives in a space that is probably smaller than the two parking spaces that went for $560,000. Let's take one more quick one. Ben and Quincy, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just wanted to put in a good word for Mayor Menino. I applaud the opportunity for people to do smaller spaces. I think the market should decide. I lived in a cottage in Berkeley, California, that was 20 feet by 20 feet when I was first married and in graduate school with no money. And it was the happiest place I ever lived. You could vacuum the whole thing without unplugging the vacuum, and it worked great for me.
So let's be clear, two people in 400 square feet.
Where'd you put the vacuum?
Where'd you put your wife? That's the other question. Now, what's the answer to that? Where did you put the vacuum, Ben? I'm sorry.
We put it in a closet. There was space. There's enough space.
Okay.
Ben, thank you for the call. Now, by the way, four out of four, Marjorie, and the lines are full. We sadly are out of time, though. Four people who waxed poetic, I would say, about small living space.
Well, you wouldn't have to spend much time cleaning. You wouldn't have to be so devoted to your Swifter, as a lot of us are. You have a Swifter, Jim?
No, I do not.
They're really wonderful. Okay, up next, it's Emily Rooney's. She's got her great Emily Rooney's list of her, I don't want to call it complaints, but her observations of the week. We're also going to get her take on Anthony Weiner, Steve the Rifleman Flemmy, and the pros and cons of cutting a deal in Boston. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH.
What's happening at the Boston Summer Arts Weekend, After Dark?
Friday night, July 26th.
A feast of jazz and blues for a sultry summer night with New Orleans legend Dr. John and the Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
And Saturday night, July 27th.
Benny Noir's diva, Angelique Kidjo, rocks the house with Carlos Nunez and Session Americana.
Presented by Citizens Bank.
Check out the entire lineup and reserve your spot now at bostonsummerarts.com.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Subaru of New England, offering the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com. And the Museum of Fine Arts presenting their newest exhibition, Hippie Chic. It's a trip to a time of far-out fashion where anything seemed possible and wearable. Details at MFA.org, sponsor of the WGBH Summer Arts Weekend.
She's the host of Greater Boston every night on WGBH at 7 o'clock. On Fridays, it morphs into Beat the Press, and Marjorie Egan is one of the panelists tonight, I should say, and she joins us every Friday in open mic. She would be Emily Rooney. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey,
hey
Jim.
Hey, Emily. So there are a million stories in the paper the last couple of days, I'm exaggerating by a little bit, about fear in South Boston. Yeah. You're taking issue with this. This, of course, there was a young woman, 24-year-old Amy Lord, who was attacked in her own apartment as she came out the door, then brought back in the vestibule, beaten up, driven around, taking money out of ATMs, and then murdered. It's a little upsetting.
First of all, I'm not diminishing the story at all because it's just horrifying. What I am saying is that these are the obligatory sidebars that both newspapers did, and a lot of TV stations did too. I mean, if something terrible happens in your neighborhood, are you instantaneously afraid? Are you looking over your shoulder? I'm going to answer for you. No. And by the way, let's face it, I don't want to convict this guy before he's convicted, but they've got the guy. You know, he's 20 days of observation. They have him on surveillance tape stabbing one of the other girls. So they know he stabbed her. So the likelihood that he stabbed Amy Lord is probably pretty good. But we always act like there's some, you know, strange maniac on the loose. It's usually one person. In this case, but I'm saying these obligatory. But they sweep. And also, it's always this women as the victim. They sweep everybody into the same stories of everybody should be so worried about their lives. It's crazy. It's not true.
Well, most the stories are a bit much, but let me just say two things in defense of, I don't know, the stories or at least the fear. One, other things that are unpleasant have been going on in South Boston in recent times beyond these three assaults. That's number one. Number two, I don't know if you read this incredibly great piece called, the title of which was Parents Balance Safety Concerns, A Desire for Children to Flourish Living in the City.
Oh, my God.
By Akilah Johnson and Nikita. Well, the best thing is this description of this woman who lives in Westboro, whose kid now is out here, went to Northeastern, and she has in her house what they call the refrigerator of death. And this is unbelievable. The mother would cut out every newspaper and magazine article she came across that chronicled some tragedy and taped them in refrigerators. The kids were growing up. And the reason I even bring that up, beyond the fact that it's a great little anecdote, is this is the environment in which non-city young people move to the city with parents who are convinced
are the anomaly. Most violent crime is an anomaly, especially stranger violent crime. It's usually within friends or family, and it just doesn't happen that often.
You know what I did not realize until I read it in the Herald this morning? That mace and pepper spray, you can't get them.
You need a permit. You can get them.
Oh, I knew that. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Weapon.
So if you wanted to go out and get some mace today, you'd be out of luck.
Yeah.
Bothered me more than the fear story is, and I sort of have mixed feelings about this because everybody is talking about it, so maybe that is the why not run stories.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of the woman has been dead for a couple of days, and I know it's an important story.
No, but what happened was yesterday afternoon that very dramatic photograph appeared, released obviously by law enforcement. They had it off of a surveillance camera. She's at Upham's Corner. A crowded street corner, sometime between 6 and 6:47 in the morning. You see her stepping out of the passenger side of the car. The car is clearly facing in one direction. It would have taken him a couple of seconds to turn around and chase after her. What? I mean, I think it's a normal question.
Yeah, I think so too. Because she looks so fit. She's in her gym outfit. She's got her sneakers on. She looks very agile. You say to yourself, okay. Yeah.
Now, she had been beaten up.
Yes.
And I'm with your producer last night who was asking those questions. Jim, how did the cops know that she was beaten
up all this stuff,
at her apartment before she was abducted and then murdered? How do they know that?
I don't know.
Well, also, but I guess the reason I was offended by it to a degree is you don't know. You don't know how badly she was beaten up and if she was part of that syndrome. You don't know if she was drugged. And, you know, the reason I think it's also coming up is because one of the most celebrated escapes in the last several months we talked about in Boston in particular was the young Chinese entrepreneur who the Tsarnaevs captured. And then remember, he ran on Starro Drive. He runs out of the car in a far more difficult situation because there are two of them there checking him out. And so in the wake of that, I think people, it's normal to ask the question.
Yeah, but I said
it just
this,
didn't feel right to me.
I said this to Michael Flaherty last night. I mean, you can't deny the fact that it's a woman and his ability to overpower her she was probably fearful of that. The fact that he could have possibly been able to run faster.
I totally agree with you.
You know,
but I think it was important to have these stories today because everybody is thinking that same thing after you see the picture. So to explain that many victims in a situation like this think if they just do what the assailant tells them, they'll be okay. Or they may be so traumatized because she was apparently beaten, thinking that, you know, if I make one step, you're going to come out and hit me in the head again. So I think it was good to run those stories because otherwise we would be talking for days.
I wonder, though, about the state of mind of the guy. I mean, was he as crazed as he was later in the day when they stopped him? He pulled stitches out of his hand. He was crouching under a bench at the courthouse. Was he behaving oddly with her? And, you know, the crazier somebody is, the more likely you're going to be able to get away.
You know what I found so distressing about this story? And I can't wait to ask Andrea Cabral when she comes up for our news quiz because she was a former prosecutor in Suffolk County. This guy had a long history of very violent attacks. You know, we get the pot dealers in jail. And the guys with the violent attacks out of jail. I mean, how does this happen over and over and over again?
Speaking of violent attacks, can we talk about something? No, and South Boston, by the way. Let's talk about what, to me, is a very disturbing possibility. As we all know, we went through days and days of the rifleman Flemmi's testimony. And Adam Riley shared with us this morning part of what was discussed in the courtroom yesterday. He's being cross-examined. Here's Flemmi. I don't know what the future holds. Everyone hopes for something beneficial. in the future. And he also tells the defense lawyer, Brennan, who's cross-examining him, everybody in the federal system knows about Rule 35. Rule 35 is the provision that says if you cooperate, you get a deal. Now, he already got a deal once. He wasn't put to death. He got life in jail.
And he's in a federal prison, which isn't too bad.
The notion that, you know, jurors know that Martirano's testimony was in part, even though he's a murderer, a serial murderer, was in part motivated by the fact that he got a great deal, what, 12 years. Kevin Weeks, similar sort of deal, fewer involvement and fewer murders, but 5 years. If it turns out that we learn after this trial is over and the juries didn't know it, that he cut a second deal and is going to maybe be released before he's dead as part of the reason for his testimony, that's pretty relevant information.
Yeah, but as
isn't
you
it?
Know, because Anthony Cardinale told you on your show last night that Rule 35 could not apply once a year has gone by. You can modify it, your deal, within a year of taking that deal, but that was years ago that he took it.
So yeah, but and Cardinale did say that to me. He said that legally he's not entitled to get a second Rule 35 shot. But while I respect his position, he's a really good lawyer too, if it turns out it's not a possibility, mm-hmm. why did the judge allow the questioning?
I don't know. They allowed that a couple times, the stuff that came up that didn't seem – I don't know.
But if Cardinale is wrong, and I don't mean to criticize him, he's probably – if he is wrong and we find out after this is all over that he cut a deal –
outrageous.
No, it is. No, the reason it is outrageous is not because deals aren't cut the other time, but all the time. But the discussion we've had, I'm sure, is the discussion, or I hope the jury would have, even if you dismiss Martirano and Weeks' testimony because of the deal they cut, all this guy got, Flemmy, theoretically, was life in jail, which is pretty horrible, too. He wasn't put to death. If we find out he gets released, was he 79?
Yeah.
Gets released at 82 or 83.
What was his line?
That's a big deal.
About hoping for something better?
Yeah, he says everyone in the I don't know what the future holds. Everyone hopes for something beneficial.
Well, did the jury hear that part of the discussion?
I don't know the answer to the question. I don't know what the answer is.
Because I agree. If the jury knew that his possibility of getting out.
Yeah, I think they must have, because
Adam's testimony.
Adam's, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Adam's notes, and I'm just reading what he sent us this morning. The government objected when Brennan introduced Rule 35 speculation to his cross-examination. If it was cross-examination, then the jury was there.
Now, how is our crusade going to open up the courtrooms in the federal courthouses,
you know,
to the television
cameras?
I'm thinking
of taking this on full time.
I think it's a great cause.
We have an intern working on it almost full time. We're obsessed, all of us.
I wrote this in the Herald last week, but if there is a Tsarnaev trial, there may not be. He may plead guilty. I don't know what's going to happen with him. But if there is a trial and you have victims who may not want to come to the courtroom, either because they're still dealing with their injuries and they're not driving, or because they just don't want to be swamped by every reporter, but they want to see this trial, can't see it.
Yeah, well, Jim, you're a policy wonk. How does one get a hearing before Congress? This is a completely legitimate issue.
Well, let me tell you why. Actually, I've done a little research, and actually, if I may, I have a piece in next Sunday's Globe magazine,
right,
since you brought it up on this very topic.
No,
there is a bill that was filed by Durbin, the Democrat, and I believe it's Grassley, the Republican senator from Illinois, to put cameras in the Supreme Court. They filed it year after year. There'll be hearings on that. It is totally relevant.
Well, they have streaming
to go test.
No,
they don't have a visuals. Or they have They have delayed audio.
Delayed audio.
It seems to me that's the forum in which the PBSs of the world, the National Public Radios
and
of the
again,
world, the GBHs.
This is an opportunity. If there is a Tsarnaev trial, because politically speaking, you look pretty crummy to be denying to victims who may want to see this
that's
trial
a great point.
The opportunity
same
to see
with
it.
Whitey.
Same with White. That's absolutely true.
Okay.
But they're not incapacitated because of their injuries, and the same way the marathon victims were.
Now, speaking of cutting a deal, Emily Rooney, everyone knows the name Flemmy. Virtually no one knows the name unless they've been reading the terrific stories by Todd Wallach, this series in the Boston Globe. Leslie Cohen Berlewitz. She is about to be the former head of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She was making somewhere in the neighborhood of $600,000 a year, well above what comparable people made. And she had phonied her academic resume. And after this whole thing is over, she's resigning next week and getting a check, one-time check for $475,000. Do you think that's justice,
this
Emily?
This is a blood sport in Boston, especially by the newspapers, running people out of town, running people out of their jobs.
That'll be us soon, Jim.
You get the drumbeat and the drip and the drip and the drip.
You don't think she deserved to be run out of town?
I don't know. Run into town.
I tell you, I will take it one step further. Not only do I think, based upon the reporting, that she should be run out of town, you know what drives me most nuts about this? Does anybody get fired in America for misdeeds anymore? She's allowed to resign. She gets a check for $475,000. It seems to me a reasonable outcome if all the facts are as we suggest. One, she's fired, not given a chance to resign. And by the way, give us back $1 million or $500,000. Everybody is allowed to resign.
We haven't heard her sign.
Oh, that's why you're being nice. That's why I'm like,
she said in Todd Wallach's piece today, I am tempted to provide a point-by-point response to the questions that have been raised in recent weeks. So keep trying, because I bet she does want to talk about this. And, you know, she did not acquit herself well. I guess she was screaming at the staffers all the time and taking first-class air flights. And she was not doing...
What's the point of being the boss if you can't do that?
I guess. But I don't know. She's 69. You know, she has to have some retirement.
Yeah,
funds,
there you go.
Jim.
You know, the more I think about this, if she actually wants to talk to somebody, she's A-OK in my book. No, really. And the settlement was totally unfair. Now, Emily, we were discussing these serious topics just as a cover for what we really want to talk about. Here is from yesterday, a scrum of reporters are trying to nail down the number of women that a former congressman and currently a mayoral candidate in New York City had engaged with online. Here's first the reporter and then Carlos Danger.
How many conversations did you have with women after you resigned that were sexual in nature?
I don't believe I had any more than three.
I mean, but I can't really
Anthony
keep
Weiner.
Track.
All right, speaking of running out of town, though, what about that woman, Ms. Leathers? Is that her name?
Yes.
That was
disgusting, too.
Which part?
Coming forward, making herself a hero, a celebrity. It's all about everybody's 15 minutes. I mean, I had nothing nice to say about her.
Well, if people haven't seen it, we were all chortling earlier in the newsroom about the cover of the New Yorker magazine. It's online. You can check it out. It has Anthony Weiner is straddling the Empire State Building, which is refitted.
Be careful.
It's refitted in a certain way so that he can take a picture of the top of the Empire State Building.
Like, you know,
I got it.
It is a riot. And the other thing I don't understand is his wife.
Yeah.
I just don't get it.
Well, somebody wrote today that she's one of those people who answers every question with a question, because I love him, because I want to stick by him. It's like, that's a question, all right. That's the way she talks.
But here she is, obviously a woman of great accomplishment. She's working for Hillary Clinton, very smart, obviously very attractive.
This is not going to end well.
When you're married to Ichabod Crane, who's sending out these pictures of himself to all these women, cut her losses.
What do you mean it's not going to end well? What does that mean?
This is not going to end well.
How can you stay?
No.
Well, you know, by the way, in the spirit of full disclosure here.
This is a despicable human being, I should say.
Weiner is.
I've said it before, but my nephew used to be his press secretary. This is a guy who refers to a young gay man as a effer, you know. It's like, come here, you little, and begins with a C.
Sucker. Oh,
yeah. Just horrible.
You know what the other thing is? I mean, people have affairs, but if you can't remember how many there were, you know, that's a problem,
too. After the fact. After he
resigned. Can we play that again? Because that is the quote of the month, I think. Can we hear this again? First, the reporter, and then he has to sort of strain his brain for a second. Here is soon to be the former mayoral candidate in New York City. Here it is.
How many conversations did you have with women after you resigned that were sexual in nature?
I don't believe I had any more than three.
I don't believe. Let me think. Wait. It was. You know what's amazing to me?
Could have been five.
Everybody's talking about the fact that there was a poll done immediately after the press conference where he was leading. He was first place by a couple of points. His favorability dropped 20 points, and he's now 9 points behind this Quinn woman. 16% of people in New York still support him.
I know. I saw
Go that. Into the head of the six. What are the 16% thinking? One out of six voters are saying, I plan to vote for
it's
him
like
in the primary.
It's like voting for Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's celebrity. It's all that. He'll be a lot of fun. But you know what was even better than that
He'll
quote?
He'll be a lot of fun.
How about that one in the underwear, the very first one? He says, it could be me. We're investigating. What do you mean it could be you? How's it possible?
Wouldn't you recognize a photograph of yourself in your underpants?
First of all, would you have one?
No, actually. That's
exactly. He's even admitting that he could have.
Can I say one more thing about her wife? I started to say in the spirit of full transparency here, there's an investigation being sought by some Republicans in Congress about her dealings when she worked for Hillary Clinton at the State Department, where she changed her employment status from full-time employee to something, I don't know what the terms were, which allowed her theoretically to engage in consulting contracts outside the State Department at the same time that she is an aide to the Secretary of State. I mean, that on its face is a little troubling to me, and I'd like to see a little bit of an investigation, too. So, who knows?
Well, maybe they were short of money after he resigned from Congress and you need to do a little outside work, Jim.
Emily, before we move on to what we're really here for, what day does he pull out of the race?
I think it's going to be in the next week.
Yeah, I'd say by the end of the weekend. How about you, Marjorie?
He might stick in.
No, it's not a chance. It's not a chance. He can't. In any case, we know this is why you're here. Here it is, Emily's list.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Here she is, Emily Rooney, of Emily's List. What do you have, Emily?
I got a short list. But it's thematic.
Sad. Okay.
It's thematic. Now, Jim, earlier today I said to you, you were going to agree with me on this one. And Marjorie's not going to. All right, here we go. People who have houses on the Cape, whether it's just summer houses or normal houses, grossly understate the time it takes to get to the Cape.
I'm good so far.
See,
I'm totally good.
I'm right. Where do you live? How long does it take you to get to the Cape, Marjorie?
If there's no traffic.
Don't give me that. If there's no traffic. How long does it take?
I'd say an hour and a half is
you've told me 70 minutes, by the way. You've told me 70 minutes.
There's nowhere you can get under an hour and 45 minutes.
So what is the part of this that bothers you?
Because people grossly understate it. Just admit it. They say, oh, I've got a summer house, and it only takes an hour to get there. Oh, it takes at least 2 hours.
I'm at exit six. No, it doesn't.
Exit six. It takes, first of all, you're always in at least an hour of traffic, no matter when you go. So
can I tell you, that's a point that it needed to be made for decades.
Thank you.
And thank God you've made it. What's your second thematic
all right,
point?
Here's one. Here's something. The Hamptons do it. Nantucket does it.
Yeah.
These shark fishing tournaments. I don't approve. We're going to haul some creature out of the ocean and, slaughter it. Now, if this were rhinos or elephants or tigers hanging upside down with their throat slit, we'd be outraged.
That's a fabulous point, by the way.
It's disgusting.
It is disgusting.
And we're like reveling in this. And I saw this little picture this week about somebody rescuing a raccoon out of a storm drain. Now, I don't let the raccoon go. But here we are, somebody heroically rescuing a raccoon, and they're slitting the throats of these
sharks. Wait, they don't throw them back in after they catch them?
They kill them.
That is horrible.
That's disgusting.
I feel so bad for those poor sharks.
After you finish the camera in the courtroom crusade, I think it's the shark crusade.
Right, I said I've got a summer-related theme here.
Good.
I don't know. I'm way out on a limb on this one.
Go ahead.
Okay.
But I've been on this one for years.
Mm-hmm.
Women cannot wear shorts. You just cannot wear shorts. It's like, as I would say, no one needs two butts. You've already got one. You don't need two butts. And there are lots of options. You can wear shifts. You can wear denim skirts. There's a million options. Uh-huh. But shorts do not work.
Can I tell you?
I've convinced all
my
friends.
How about men?
Men can.
Yeah.
It's funny. I tweeted a couple of weeks ago that men should almost never wear shorts.
Well, most men shouldn't.
I mean, because they don't know what goes on their feet that should accompany the shorts.
Generally speaking, don't have two butts if they do.
No, that's a very good point. How long have you been holding that inside?
Oh, my gosh. I got my sisters convinced. I've got most of my friends. It's like...
How about the skorts?
I brought them over. I even go hiking in a skirt. Climb mountains in a skirt.
Skort. What about the skort?
Yeah, they're okay.
Yeah, those are the skirts with the center panel.
We know
whatever.
You're on fire.
All right, I'm on fire. I only have one more.
Oh, that's very
maybe
sad.
You all knew this.
What's that?
I did not. We're all very conscious of radar in the summer because we like to speed when we're trying to make it to the Cape under an hour.
That's right.
I did not know that radar is an acronym. Did you?
No.
Did you?
No. Nope.
Anybody in the control room know that? Did you know that radar is an acronym? Radar is radio detection and ranging. It's an acronym.
By the way, and that's Chelsea's just telling us in our ear, that's why Under the Radar, Callie Show, is all in caps, because apparently someone knows. What does it stand for again?
Radio detection and ranging.
That is
I did not know that. And that is my summer Emily's list.
Wow.
Something to know and tell.
Do you think if you point that out to the state trooper, you'll get out of the ticket?
Maybe.
Maybe.
That
you can give him a quiz.
Marjorie said it was an hour to get to the Cape. I'm just,
I tell you, it's almost hard to talk after that radar thing. What are you doing tonight other than having Marjorie as a guest on Beat the Press?
Well, we're going to be talking about Bill Belichick. After his press conference, the sports media, anyway, went crazy praising him. How articulate and humane. And this, I said, I thought he was a lot like the old Bill Belichick myself, but just a little bit more talkative. But I thought they went overboard in their praise of him. People were very harsh on him beforehand with expectations, but then, when he came through I've got my. And then we're going to do the royal. I can't wait for this part of it because we're doing the royal baby.
Whether
Americans, whether the press in particular on this side of the pond went crazy for that.
Go ahead, Marjorie.
I am crazy for it
well,
myself.
It's going to be all your segment.
Every opportunity. I told Kelly I watch repeats of Will and Kate Plus One on CNN. I watched it once. I watched it twice. I watched it yet again.
I'll tell you, though, because I'm going to point this out, too, that the ratings were, like, very average.
There
was no spikes for either the cables or the networks or those two specials they did this week.
How heartening is that?
Yeah, it is.
It really is.
I love
every minute of that.
And we have something else.
We'll be watching. Emily Rooney, thanks.
Thank
we really appreciate it.
Bye. Emily Rooney, it does only take an hour to get to the Cape.
No, it's not. No, she does it when Emily's off her mic.
Okay.
Notice?
Okay. Emily joins us every Friday for one at Open Mic, and you can find her on WGBH-TV every weekday night, at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston, tonight on Beat the Press. Up next, we're rushing the season because technically Secretary's Day is not until April, but we're marking the holiday anyway on our Friday News Quiz with Matt Malone, State Secretary of Education, and Andrea Cabral, State Secretary of Public Safety and Security. Keep your dial at 89.7. WGBH.
Some of the best musicians on the planet are coming to the American Ballroom at the Westin Copley Place tomorrow night for the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend After Dark, presented by Citizens Bank. Like folk rock supergroup Session Americana, Brooklyn Indian funk band Red Barat, plus Carlos Nunez, Ryan Montbleu, and the amazing Miss Angelique Kidjo. But act fast, tickets are extremely limited. Visit bostonsummerarts.com to learn more.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Poland Spring Nature's Blends, spring water blended with fruit flavors, available in 7 flavors, including lemon mint and acai grape. You can find them at your local grocery and convenience stores. And Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham. This active senior community in a natural setting offers something for everyone. You can find out what many seniors have already discovered at experiencenewbridge.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're calling this Secretary's Day here at WGBH. Joining us to take on the week's headlines on our Friday news quiz is Andrea Cabral. She's the Secretary of Public Safety and Security of the Commonwealth. Hello, Secretary Cabral.
How are you, Mr. Browdy?
Nice to see you. And we're also joined by Matt Malone. He is the Secretary of Education. Welcome back, Secretary Malone.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Are you
for
really?
Being
you don't
here.
Look happy. Are you really happy?
I am so excited right now. It's the best day of my life getting to see you both again.
That's right. Now, Andrea Cabral, before we start, a couple of things. You a minute ago were saying I don't want to put words in your mouth. How terrific! You were commenting on Marjorie and me as radio talk shows. Give us a summary of what you just said, please.
Well, I wasn't commenting necessarily on you and Marjorie in particular, but in the main.
Yeah, what were you saying?
How this is precisely the kind of job that everyone wants.
What's
the one
that?
Where you get to literally opine on every
Correct.
Single thing that every single person does and sit in judgment of everyone
yes.
and then talk about how you feel about it.
That's right.
That is a real job.
You're
no,
jealous,
that's good.
Aren't you?
I'll trade you 20 minutes at public safety, right? For 20 minutes of this.
I think you should come in when Jim's on vacation. We can go at it together,
I
Andrea.
Think that would be
and
great.
It's very good for your blood pressure, like getting it all out. You know
I
what I mean?
It
getting it all out.
It's very
yeah.
therapeutic.
Now, I know
Absolutely.
That both of you, both Secretary Malone and Secretary Cabral, requested to be on the quiz show because you wanted to discuss the underside of the Patrick administration. So should we start? And also, you know, by the way, I should say to you to your face, you were the keynote speaker at my younger daughter's city year graduation a few months ago, got a standing ovation. You were really terrific, by the way.
I appreciate that.
Can I ask you a quick question? What's going on with this initiative? The governor looked for $2 billion, transportation, education. They gave him two-thirds of what he wanted, well, half of what he wanted on transportation, zeroed out the education side. Are you guys giving up on this, or what's happening?
No, that's actually not true. The governor put forward a budget proposal of $900 million investment. We got $300 million.
Oh, in the budget, finally
in the
you
budget.
Did? Okay.
So, I mean, we're on the beach. We got a beachhead, and we're moving forward. And I applaud the work of the House and the Senate to invest in education, and I've been very upfront that we're coming back to ask for additional investments.
But he said he needed $1 billion in new taxes, and if there are no new taxes to fund the $300 million, where's the dough coming from?
Growth in revenue in the budget, I think, and they've also prioritized and made some different decisions as they've gone through. The governor's full proposal, the $900 million, would have required increase in taxes on to fund the revenue package. We weren't successful in getting that this year, but we didn't lose. The governor got $300 million further investment in education. Look, we got a funding freeze, tuition freeze at UMass because we got closer to funding the operating costs. We got a huge investment, highest ever in Chapter 70 to fund K-12, and we got $21 million at early childhood.
See? He's a glass half full kind of guy.
No, he is.
He's
That's great news.
Okay, do I get one question before we start this whole thing? Andrew Cabral, I asked you this because you were a former prosecutor in Suffolk County. Maybe I'm wrong about this, and if so, you can disabuse me of this notion. But I was reading about this this guy that attacked people in South Boston,
allegedly,
may or may not be involved in this murder of this young 24-year-old woman, with a rap sheet of violent attacks that's pretty extensive. And it seems to me that I'd like to see the violent people in jail for very, very long periods of time, and maybe fewer drug dealers in jail or certainly pot dealers and stuff like that. Am I wrong about that? Are we still in Massachusetts kind of getting soft? Are we still soft on violent sentencing in Massachusetts?
Well, I don't know that we were ever necessarily soft on sentencing for violent crimes. I think that there are two parts sort of to your question. One is whether or not there is a proportional response in terms of sentencing between violent criminals, nonviolent criminals, drug-addicted people who also sell and so on and so forth. I think that's sort of separate from whether or not you can actually make the case that we were ever soft on violent crime. But the bottom line is everyone who is not serving life without the possibility of parole is going to continuously be eligible for parole,
right,
no matter what period of time they're sentenced for. I mean, one of the reasons why we're focusing on mental illness, particularly in the Patrick administration, is because that is so frequently a component. And I think it's going to, based on what I read today,
yes,
is going to be a component of this as well. Mental illness as part of crime generally is far, far too prevalent. And the problem that we face is that people with mental illnesses are sent to jail. They are seen by psychiatrists. They're treated. They are stabilized on medication. When they leave, they have medication that will last them for perhaps 60 days. And they have follow-up. They're referred back to psychiatrists. They're referred to treatment. But as you know, the nature of mental illness is that people frequently don't like the way the medication makes them feel.
Right.
They begin to feel better. They then think they can control the mental illness because the way they feel today is the way they're always going to feel. The medication wears off. They start to decompensate, and we're right back. That's the reason for mental health courts. That's precisely the reason why we now have several mental health courts in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that just look at people whose primary driver for their criminal behavior is mental illness and deals with that. You can do far fewer cases, but you get them done more thoroughly, and you stabilize people in the outside world with medication, housing, and employment.
That's the voice of Secretary Andrea Cabral. She's the Secretary of Public Safety. She is competing today in a cutthroat competition with the Secretary of Education. That would be Matt Malone. You want to ask the first question of Secretary Malone, Marjorie?
Sure.
By the way, the deal is you listen to the sound, after which you answer. If you get it wrong, your opponent has an opportunity to what we call steal the question. Go right ahead, Marjorie.
Okay, ready, Secretary Malone?
Yes.
Which newsmaker is Stephen Colbert describing here?
All this cyber flashing happened just last summer. At the same time, he was telling People magazine, I feel like a different person. Turns out it was true. He was a different person. Carlos Danger.
That would be Mr. Wiener.
Yes, it was.
That is correct. Okay, here's a bonus question. What Fox News host had his own revealing Twitter moment, last Saturday when he posted a selfie wearing only a towel?
Carlos Danger.
Give him half a point for that. Do you know who it is?
Do you happen to know?
Repeat the question.
What famous Fox News host had his own revealing Twitter moment last Saturday when he posted a selfie wearing only a towel?
I hope to God it was Sean Hannity.
No, that would have been great.
Geraldo Rivera.
No. Yes.
Hey, let me ask you both a question before we move to the next thing. Secretary Malone got the points. We were talking yesterday. I think we broached this with Brian McGorry from the Globe, too, the other day. Spitzer, Elliot Spitzer, we know what he did, former governor, is leading by a lot in the race for controller. Mm-hmm. Until this press conference a day ago or 2 days ago, Anthony Weiner was leading the race for mayor. Could anybody with that background ever be a serious candidate for a municipal office in Boston? You live in Boston, Andrea Cabral. Could they be?
Back when the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky thing was going on, there was a gentleman who from Australia who wrote into the newspaper there called The Australian. Mm-hmm. And all of Australia, as much of Europe, was laughing at the fact that we were so obsessed with Bill Clinton's peccadilloes. And what he wrote was, thank God they got the Puritans and we got the convicts. And there's a reason for that. That I do think that there is a puritanical streak in the New England states, and maybe most acutely in Massachusetts, that level of judgment, that finger shaking, that you're going to, you know, right after we finish yelling at you, we're going to put you in the stocks in the common and people are going to throw rotten fruit at you all day. I think that's part of, in some
Weiner
ways, who we are.
Should be in the stocks in the common. Could
anybody... Well, I get that one, but you know, Elliot Spitzer is brilliant. Elliot Spitzer, it was a good public
servant. And took
sermon.
On Wall Street big time. Yeah, he did. Yeah. Could anybody win? You were in Brockton at one point. Could somebody be mayor of Brockton with this background, Matt Malone? I think we have your answer. Thank you very much. Next question, for an attempt to tie it up, Andrea Cabral, Secretary of Public Safety. What one-day event is Charlie Baker referring to in this clip from our radio show on Monday? The hint is the opportunity only rarely presents itself.
He should quickly go out and get one of those portraits of himself done and hang it in the in the entrance to the governor's office. I was also thinking that, you know, maybe it might be fun to go in and just completely screw around with all the furniture and all the filing everywhere.
So here's the question. What one-day event, it happened last week, is Charlie Baker referring to in this clip from our show on Monday?
Wait a minute. Secretary Malone gets a question that literally has gotten global coverage, and you ask me about something that happened on a show that is listened to by three people.
No, actually, it was we had a big audience on Monday.
Did you have a big audience?
You don't know. Is that correct?
No, I don't. What one-day event?
Well, I'm not going to tell you. Do you have any idea what it is, Secretary Malone?
Based on the clip, I'm going to do some analysis, interpretation. I'm going to say something about Secretary of State Galvin.
That is correct. You're on fire. He took over for the one day that the governor was in Chicago paying off his bet on the Stanley Cup. Yes.
Jim.
Yes.
I am the Secretary of Education.
Yes, you are. That is a very...
There you go.
Made that connection.
That's right. Where are you in line behind the governor? You guys. I mean, you're secretary. Are you,
she's
shaking
her head.
Succession
millions
here?
Would have to die or be incapacitated,
Okay, next question.
I've asked because I just want to, you know, get my opportunity.
Well, it seemed to me it should be after the Secretary of State. Why not the Secretary of Education?
I've asked. Yeah. The governor said, no way in hell.
Okay.
Next question for Secretary Malone.
Okay, Secretary, see if you can tell what this man is talking about here.
He's got a good pair of lungs on him, that's for sure. He's a big boy, he's quite heavy, but we're still working on a name, so we'll have that as soon as we can. But it's the first time we've seen him, really, so having a proper chance to catch up and see him. I'll remind him of his tardiness when he's a bit older.
I believe that he's referring to one George Alexander Louis, or...
Yeah?
Boy,
that is
you
correct.
Are prepared.
That is correct.
And my question will be, name five things that taste like lima beans. Are you kidding
that
me?
That is your question.
Okay, here's the bonus question.
Are there five things?
No, there's nothing else that tastes like lima beans.
She's bitter.
Do you know, Secretary Malone, what Massachusetts royal family also welcomed a new offspring into the fold on the same day as William and Kate welcomed baby George?
Massachusetts royalty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in quotes,
in
royalty,
quotes.
Yeah. This one beat you?
This one's got me.
Do you know what? She actually knows. Andrea Cabral, you can get a point here. What is it, Andrea?
I think Romney had a grandchild.
That is exactly.
We
correct. Call him former Governor
Josh,
Romney, is how we refer to him.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm,
and
thank you.
Jen welcomed Mitten Ann's 22nd grandchild.
It's a lot of grandkids.
Can you imagine at Christmas trying to keep all that straight?
So at this point,
names.
I believe it is Secretary Malone, Secretary of Education, 3. Andrea Cabral, Secretary of Public Safety. You've broken into the scoring margin. It's one. Don't look at the questions, Secretary Cabral.
I'm not looking
Cabral,
at the questions.
You.
I just can't believe that. Go ahead.
Okay, here's
Jim
your question.
Jim picked all the hard ones for you, Andrea.
Here's the
it
question,
purpose.
Andrea Cabral.
Yeah.
What educator once had as his motto, trash is our enemy, homework is our friend, in the Duxbury Middle Schools? It's not a real question. It was Secretary Malone, because one of our producers, Abby, went to the doctor. Isn't that great? Trash is our enemy. Homework is our friend. You did that, right, Secretary Malone?
That is my platform speech.
Okay. Now, here's your question, Andrea Cabral, to close the gap between the two of you. What ailing institution, don't complain about the question either, please. What ailing institution is Stephen Colbert talking about in this clip, and why would it be in the news this particular week? Please.
Nation, I have said for years that the is a fraud. If it's really first class, why doesn't my letter get a complimentary cocktail and a hot towel? Well, fortunately, the is about to be returned to sender.
What ailing institution is Colbert talking about in the clip?
The United States Postal Service.
That's exactly right, and the reason is because there are all these hearings. You know, they're thinking about ending door-to-door service in a decade, and you'd only get your mail delivered to the curb? I mean, really?
Or they put it in a central box.
They don't actually cost us money. The only reason they're in debt is because Congress forced them to pay their pension up front. Which is no one else
you are
is forced
so
to do.
Right. That it's is exactly correct.
So they
correct.
Created a situation where they're in debt, and now they say they're too debt-ridden to remain functioning the way they always have. It's
Can you
not
imagine
fair.
If you live in an apartment building with 40 apartments, and they're going to throw it all in one big container, and the 40 people are going to go sorting through?
Be like the Coliseum.
Be a disaster.
You know, the first thought I had when I heard about the post office, the debate in Congress, the first thing I said to myself, I called Marjorie that night, and I said, you know, Marjorie, trash is our enemy. Homework is our friend. Isn't that what you saw at Secretary Malone at the same time?
I thought the same thing.
I knew you would. That's why I figured
I'm
I'd bring it up.
Right now.
3-2.
Looking out the window.
Secretary Malone has a narrow lead over Secretary Cabral.
Don't I get a bonus question so I can tie it up?
There's no bonus question.
Get
you didn't get
question.
The trash is our enemy was the bonus question. You didn't get it right.
Okay here go. We go, Secretary Malone. We're going to play you a hit from 1980. To whom in the news this week could this song be referring?
Everyone around me is a total stranger. Everyone avoids me like a cyclone ranger. Everyone. That's why I'm turning Japanese. I think I'm turning Japanese. I really think so.
Okay, what do you think?
First and foremost, is that the Tubes?
Is that the Tubes in there?
I think it's the Talking Heads.
No, it's not the Talking Heads.
Okay.
All right. I believe that song could possibly be referenced to one Caroline Kennedy.
Wow.
The new ambassador to Japan.
Very good.
Now, do you think that question was unfair to Andrea Cabral or no?
I'm waiting for his bonus question so he can deny me one.
I guess the bonus question is the band.
Well, yours is what band was that? You got a bonus question. The producers just said.
No, he gets a bonus question. He answered it right. I get a bonus question on my question.
He didn't. He got it wrong. So what's the band?
You have no respect for rules, who the band? I'm disappointed.
Do you have any idea who the band is?
No.
Is that David Byrne? I'm going to guess.
No, that's the
Vapors. Sorry. Okay, fine. Vapors. Well, it's too late, Secretary Malone.
I thought it was the Talking Heads.
Okay, here. That's what I thought. David Byrne. Yeah. Okay, now here's your chance to close the gap. In fact, you can tie things up here. By the way, we're going to save enough time at the end of the show because I know one of the things you wanted me to do, Andrea Cabral, was talk about the first time I interviewed you on New England Cable News. Is that true? Or?
You are tireless.
Okay,
you really
thank
are.
You. Well, let's speak quickly so we can get to that. Okay. Now, here's a question for Secretary of Public Safety Cabral. Who is the commander-in-chief? This is great, actually. This Fox anchorman is talking about.
Former President showing support for a little boy battling leukemia. He shaved his own head. Two-year-old Patrick on his lap there is the son of a member of his Secret Service detail. He began losing his hair after starting cancer treatments. The boy did, and the former commander-in-chief decided to go bald with him after noticing several members of a security team had shaved their heads. Patrick's prognosis is apparently good.
What president shaved his head, in essence, to show solidarity with a little boy who was battling leukemia?
George Herbert Walker Bush. And it was a lovely thing to do.
It really was.
It was great.
It was a the guy, thing
for
to
those
do.
Who didn't see it, first of all, it's a beautiful picture with the kid sitting on his lap. He was showing support for the son of a member of a security detail who, as we said, is suffering from leukemia. He is really an impressive character, I have to say, the former president. I believe we are tied, judges. Is that correct? We're not? 4-3 still, Secretary Malone? That's too bad there, Secretary Cabral. I'm sorry. You can widen your lead here, Secretary Malone, so go for it.
Okay, and Secretary Malone, of course, is the education Secretary
Malone.
He is.
That's
true. Here we go. Here's a news clip from earlier this week. Who went from being a hermit to hero for a day?
And this accident happened in Seminole County. It involved two parents and their two children. They rolled over after losing control. They were not injured. However, according to the Seminole County Sheriff's deputy who responded to the scene, the occupants of that vehicle said two men approached them to help pull them out of their upside-down truck. One of those men was and if, in fact, that is true, we presume the other one is the bodyguard that he's been living with and traveling with for most of the past year and also wearing his bulletproof vest for his own personal safety.
Okay, Secretary Malone, what do you think?
Allegedly, George Zimmerman.
That is correct.
That is George. Allegedly, it's interesting, meaning you have some doubt that it is real. Is that what you're saying? You should feel free.
I'm not making a judgment there. I'm just saying I wasn't there and there is no evidence of support. But if that was so, that is a kind and honorable thing to do.
On a very serious note, we talked at the beginning of the show about
Jim
the second.
Jim was suspicious.
The second juror in the Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case coming out, Andrew Cabral. Both jurors have said, one who thought he should be convicted of something and ultimately voted for acquittal, and the first juror, both said they never discussed race. They never thought race was an issue, even to discuss. I'm not saying it should have determined the outcome. Do you find that at all surprising after the fact, based upon what you know, observing this from afar?
My reaction to that is that if race was never even discussed, it's because it was that prominent enough an issue in their minds that they felt constrained about discussing it openly, which makes me even more afraid about how much it actually was an unspoken issue.
How about you, Secretary Malone?
I'm conflicted of the whole situation in general. I mean, it's just, aside from all the other folks that have been talked about, the other facts that have been talked about, it just is an example, especially when you're a dad with children, of just how fast things can get out of control and how deadly the consequences can be.
That they can be. Here is a question for you, Secretary Cabral. The CNN correspondent is describing the mob scene for the visit of a globally known figure. Who would the CNN correspondent be talking about?
They're presenting him with their soccer banners, it looks like, T-shirts with dolls. Everybody just wants to touch this guy. They absolutely are crazy for him. I can tell you, we're here at the beach now. It's going to be 6 or 7 hours before he makes his way down here. But there are hundreds of people waiting out here in the rain.
So who is the person about whom they are speaking?
That would be the Pope.
That would be the Pope. That is exactly correct. Now, is it true as we go to the bonus round with only 2 minutes left that Andrew Cabral is behind by 1 point? In the spirit of equity, with your permission, Secretary Malone, because we don't want there to be tension in cabinet meetings, we're going to ask the first bonus question to you, Andrew Cabral. So if you lose, you have no complaining. You have an opportunity to tie this up on your way back to work. What do you think of that?
I just can't believe I show up here.
Exactly. No, okay. I understand that.
All right. Why don't I ask Andrew the question?
Yeah, please.
I'll ask the question.
Please.
Okay. Here we go, Andrea. What inspired Catherine Gibbs to open her school?
No, you have to, yeah, you got to start
oh,
with the
excuse
thing.
Excuse me. I goofed it up.
Go ahead.
Since both of you are secretaries, we're going to ask you about the Catherine Gibbs School. Excuse me, I should have said that right at the beginning. In its day, of course, it was the premier school for secretarial training. So here's the question. Do you know what inspired Catherine Gibbs to open up her school? This is multiple choice. A, widowed at early age, making ends meet by selling her jewelry, she decided there had to be a better way for single women to support themselves. That's A. B, disgraced by her boss because she could not change a typewriter ribbon, she decided it was time to elevate the skills and role of the secretary. Or C, she didn't open the school. Her uncle, Ernest Gibbs, founded the school but named it after Catherine so it would appeal to aspiring professional women.
You can tie it up
this
if you get it
hard.
Right.
This is hard.
I would pick C.
Well, you would pick the wrong answer.
Now, I would pick that one, too.
Do you have any idea what the answer is, Secretary Malone?
Carlos Danger.
Exactly. Now, Secretary Malone, let me leave this to you. We only have a minute left. Would you like to hear the story about the first time I interviewed Andrew Cabral
no,
or not?
Say no.
What is the answer?
She
I'm sorry.
She was
widowed
at
an early age.
Say no.
And making ends meet by selling jewelry.
That was my second guess.
Okay, it's fine. You don't get a second guess.
Now,
Secretary Cabral,
tell him no. It's a ridiculous story.
Would you like to hear the story?
It's completely false.
Would you like to hear the story? Yes, thank you. I'd be happy to. Now,
Matt,
I'm not going to tell you what leads. Really we only have 30 seconds. Matt. I'm not going to give you what leads. Andrea Cabral, the first time I ever interviewed her on NECN, we had a little back and forth. I'm not going to say what it was about. On the air live, I asked her the same question, not once, but three times during the interview because I was not satisfied with the response. After I asked you the question, I thought quite respectfully the third time on live television. What did you say on live television, Secretary Cabral? You were the sheriff of Suffolk County, a public official time. What did you say to me?
I refuse to engage in your pathologically false retelling of this story.
Secretary Malone, what she said to me was, Jim, if you ask me that question one more time, I will take you out to the parking lot and kick the crap out of you. Now, do you find that believable?
I wanted her to do it. And I hope that maybe after we're done here.
Secretary Matt Malone is the Secretary of Education. He'll be back soon to talk about education matters. Secretary of Public Safety Andrea Cabral should be back to talk about her work. Yes, you will.
No.
We really appreciate both of you. You were great and great contestants. We will have you back on The Thing You Do for a Living. Tune in Monday, please. Open mic is with Reverend Eugene Rivers. We're also going to talk to film critic Garen Daly about why Hollywood continues to pour billions into colossal flops. I am Jim Browdy. Oh, you're on Beat the Press tonight at 7 o'clock.
Yes, I am.
I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
We'll talk to you Monday at noon. Thanks.